welcome to another Friday edition of the After Show podcast. We decided to do two podcasts today because we went longer. Although, to be fair, in the first podcast that we did for the After Show, it wasn't particularly good. But it is Friday. We just played YouTube clips and listened to music. It's Friday, so whatever it is. Okay, so Sarah Smith is was on the show today. She came in studio. Well, she didn't really come in studio for us. We had a phone interview booked with her, but she happened to be in studio for a different show. So we're like, hey, let's just do it now. She is the socialist Democrat who's running up against Adam Smith in, I believe, Washington's 9th district.
It was very cool of her to come on the show.
Yeah, okay.
I feel like that's
she probably
in my experience anyway.
She didn't know.
Yeah.
She's new.
Yeah.
But I thought I was nice to her. And,
yeah.
You know, I like talking to people who I disagree with, particularly the socialists. My intent is never to yell at people. Like, that's not, every once in a while I'll raise my voice. If I have to,
with Randy Bossy, who yeah, went into that,
I didn't at all. I didn't raise my voice with Randy Boss.
I guess that's true.
He raised his. I was very purposefully but not raising my voice. I went in hot.
Yeah, you did.
But I didn't. Well, my second question was hot. My first question was not. My first.
I was
question,
expecting you to like lean into it a little, or just.
I just leaned in. I jumped in.
To lean into it.
But with Sarah Smith, it's always interesting because this is a conservative talk show, or it's a show on a conservative station. And so the implication is, you know, I'm going to always just get into a shouting match with people I disagree with. I want to know where they're coming from, and I push and I prod a little bit. I don't always like, that's wrong, sir, ma'am, that is the worst thing. Like, yeah. I don't find that interesting, really. So with Sarah, we went very long. How long is this interview? Like
25
minutes? You know, we covered a whole host of things, and I kind of just want to figure out what she believes and why she believes it. I push back when appropriate, but it's more along the lines of the series of interviews we do where I just kind of want to know what she stands for and what she believes in.
And she was really charming. And
yeah, she's a nice person. She's clearly a smart person.
Fun to listen to.
I disagree with a lot of what she says, but, you know, whatever. She disagrees with a lot of what I say, and I'm equally smart and charming. shut up. Here's my full interview with Sarah Smith right after this commercial break. Democratic socialist Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez upset the political world when she defeated the incumbent congressman, Democrat Joe Crowley, in New York. And now some people are pointing to a local race, wondering if the same thing could happen here. Sarah Smith is running against Adam Smith in Washington's 9th congressional district that runs from Bellevue through South Seattle to North Tacoma. There's no relationship between the two, although maybe that would have been an even better story of anger between family members running for Congress. Sarah Smith joins me in studio. Good morning. Thanks for coming on.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So you're comparing yourself, or at least the slate of what Ocasio-Cortez stands for to what you stand for. Is that the what you want to do, or do you kind of feel like I kind of want to run my own race?
I mean, I love running with a slate of people. It's not any different than what the Republicans do. It's not any different than what the Democratic Party does. They won't let us in, so we're organizing outside, and we have our shared platform. I mean, we obviously all have some differences in certain areas, but for the most part, where it counts on policy, we all agree on brand new Congress and Justice Democrats. We're all on the same wavelength on this, on our policy, and I think that's important to people.
Why don't they let you in?
There's a lot of reasons for that. So there's this illusion of hierarchy that exists, this illusion of, oh, start at school board and work your way up. There's illusion that you have to kiss the ring first. And then you have a bunch of us outsiders coming together who are saying, no, we want to stand up for working people. We don't think that there's any more time to wait. Climate change isn't going to wait. Sick people who don't have health care aren't going to wait. We don't have time. And no one else is stepping up to the plate to fight for them. So we're choosing to do it.
How do you describe yourself politically?
Politically, I'd say I'm very progressive. Political labels, I think, are they're too boxy to me. We narrow ourselves in when we say we're one political label. If I say I'm a Democrat, then I've lumped myself into a box, whether or not people want me to. And it makes it harder to talk to people. So I think what's more important is we're talking to issues. And I talk about progressive because I'm about proactive politics. I'm about progress. I'm about seeing real change. I'm about seeing tangible change with what we're doing and what we're working towards. But I mean, I think if I had to pick a label, I'd definitely pick progressive.
So you and Adam Smith, who's the incumbent, on some key issues, there's no difference, right? I mean, single-payer health care, both support. Minimum wage increase to $15, both support. When you look at free college tuition, both support. Where are the big differences?
Well, it didn't take me 22 years to arrive at any of these conclusions. He's coming to these conclusions now after 22 years in office. I'm just starting here. He could have been signed on to single payer for the last 14 years and he didn't step up to the plate. He could have been signed on to education for all and he didn't step up to the plate. He could have been all about a living wage, not just a $15 wage. And he didn't step up to the plate on a national scale. But I mean, he had years and years to step up to the plate and he didn't until he got a progressive challenger.
So you think it's not a legitimate position that he's taking on these issues, that he's only taking them because he's running against someone who happens to be further to the left of him?
I think it's awfully convenient that he's suddenly taking all these positions right around election season when he has a progressive challenger.
Now, is it possible that he evolved?
It's entirely possible that he's evolved.
Have you evolved on issues?
Of course, yeah. I've evolved on some issues. I think that that is important, but I think you have to start somewhere. And you can't start thinking that access to healthcare is enough. You have to start knowing that all people deserve the ability to go to the doctor and seek preventative care. Mm-hmm. All people deserve the ability to go to school and get educated, technical school, vocational school, career programs, university and college. All people should have the ability to do this and then work as hard as they possibly can without worrying about thousands of dollars in debt looming over their head, crushing them before they even have a chance to get to work.
How much of, let's talk about the student debt and free college in general, because I'm young enough where I remember what it was like to be in college, and I had student loan debt just like a lot of people. I made the choice to go to a college that was outside of what I could afford without having to take on student loan debt. Why should I get a pass at having to pay off those student loan debts? Because a lot of people, Elizabeth Warren, one of them, we want to basically erase the student loan debt that we've made the choice to take on.
Because right now we're sitting under a $1.5 trillion student debt bubble. It's hamstringing people from starting families. Young people aren't not having kids or not getting married. They're not buying houses. They're not participating in the economy. Right now, it's we have this idea that this got mine idea, like I did it this way, so why can't everyone do it this way? We don't look at people's experiences. A lot of people don't have that choice. Like for me, I worked full time through college. I put myself through college. I'm paying my own student debt. But at the same time, I'm being crushed under the weight of it. And I have to wonder what my budget looks like mm-hmm. every month. And when we oppress people like that under that kind of crushing debt, when we're looking at this $1.5 trillion bubble and we're saying, oh, well, I did it this way, so all these other people can do it this way, we're not looking at the economic impact of that.
But we don't oppress them. Right? I mean, you chose to go to a school the way I chose to go to a school. I could have, in theory, gone because I went to Occidental College, extremely expensive private school in Southern California. Mm-hmm. I could have went to UCLA, which would have been considerably cheaper, and I was accepted to UCLA. I made the choice. How? Who's oppressing me?
I think that when we have private loan companies that are out there, when we have people that aren't fully educated in how student loans work, as an 18-year-old, I didn't 100% know how student loans work.
And no one does it at 18.
Yeah, right? No one does it at 18. But we send these kids off to college and we say, oh, sign here and you'll get your money. And these kids don't really know better. Mm-hmm. And some of their parents try and some of their parents don't have the ability to. Some of their parents don't really know. So they graduate from school and they realize, oh, my God, this is crushing debt. And now all of a sudden they're paying 50% or more of their income in student loans.
So why not education on that? So why not say,
I'd love to see education on that, but that's
why not first.
But I'd love to see that. And some colleges do try to do that first. Some high schools try to do that, but not all. It's mm-hmm. not an equitable process. And then you also have people that come from low income areas that just want to better their lives, that want to seize that American dream. And the best way we've been told how to do that is through education, and not just university education, but technical school and vocational school as well. We need skilled laborers. We need trade skills. If we have this need in the market for them, we need to give people the ability to get themselves educated in these areas too. Because when people are paying hundreds of dollars in student debt, they're not putting those hundreds of dollars back into the economy.
Well, your basic point in a lot of this, particularly when you focus on vocational schools, you want people to learn a trade because then they would go into a job that they can sustain themselves mm-hmm. and contribute to the community. So when I look at something like an idea of free college tuition, I get it. It's romantic, right? I mean, and I went to college. I want everyone to go to college if it's right for them. But does it make sense to pay for a kid who is going to get a degree in something that may not lead to a meaningful job where they're going to be able to sustain themselves? Photographers, good for you. Dance theory, awesome if that's your passion. But we would all acknowledge that you're going to have a tough time in the workforce with those degrees. Does it make sense for me to pay for that versus maybe switching and say, okay, we'll pay if you're going into certain types of education?
But I think when you pick and choose like that, it changes the way that we approach education as a whole. When people major in whatever it is that they choose to and they're passionate about and they get this education, they're learning more than just that subject,
sure.
Right? I have a classics degree. I learned how to research. I learned how to synthesize information. I learned how to analyze information. I learned a lot more than just what is Greek history. I learned a ton more than that. And those skills have become essential. So when you learn something, when you go to school for the arts, arts are important. Arts are an expression of present day politics. They're an impression of the world around us. They're expressions of
why should I pay for it?
Because we have a social obligation. We all enjoy these things together, and we might disagree that we have a social obligation. I can see on your face we might disagree.
Just a little bit.
But I think we have an obligation to improve the world around us for everybody.
And what does that mean?
We don't get to define what other people's paths are, right? We all talk about this freedom to be who we want to be who we are. Who are we as a country to say what that looks like for everybody? We talk about loosening up government control on our lives, right? And if we turn around and we tighten that vice grip on education, then how can we turn around and say that the government can't decide my life for me, but it can decide my education? It seems like a conflicting viewpoint to me.
But you don't necessarily take the position that you want the government to loosen the grip. When you take a position of we would be compelling you to pay for this benefit to other people.
I think when you live in a society, you have an obligation to help that society be as great as it possibly can be. And you have an obligation to your neighbors to make sure that all of our lives are good. Because when one of us is coming up, the people around us are going to come up. We all have this obligation to live in this country together and make it coherent and make it work. That's why we have things like police forces. That's why we have mm-hmm. things like road crews. Because we're watching our fellow society members better the world around us, better our cities. And this is just one other way to better it.
How would we pay for this?
And
if you say fair share, I'm going to lose it because I don't know what that means.
I'm kidding. There's tons of ways to pay for it. We have a military parade coming up. Why aren't we taking that money?
How much would this? So actually, let's set it this way. In theory, about how much would it cost under a plan that you would endorse to pay for college?
I think college comes out to something about $300 million a year, roughly. I think it might be more than that.
It can't be. It's got to be way more than that.
It's way more than that. It's got to be more like, it's probably more like $600 million to a billion a year.
It's going to be way more than that as well.
It's going to be a lot. So it's a lot of money. Bernie Sanders talked about this. He talked about the Robin Hood tax on Wall Street. It was like a 0.01% tax on every stock that's traded. And that would be earmarked specifically for education. We need to stop being afraid to earmark certain taxes and make sure they are delegated to certain things. We haven't audited the Pentagon. We haven't audited the DOD. Mm-hmm. We have a $717 billion yearly military budget that we don't audit them. So we don't know if they actually need. We're throwing tax dollars at F-35s that don't fly. We're throwing billions of dollars on planes that we're putting in the Tucson Boneyard.
That's not going to cover it long term.
Over time it will. But if we're no longer making those expenditures mm-hmm. and we're no longer spending that stuff and we're able to reduce our military budget, that frees up all the existing tax dollars. That frees up our ability to long term invest in these kinds of things. It's not going to be an overnight process.
Sure.
But it will still be a process. It was anywhere that has debt-free college, it was never an overnight thing. It never happened at the drop of a hat. It happened over time. And we just have to start somewhere, right? Journey of 1,000 miles begins with one step. And we have to start somewhere. We can't just be terrified to try. We can't be terrified and put it off constantly because we're like, oh, but what about 20 years from now? Mm-hmm. We know over time it's going to catch up. We know over time that these investments are going to catch up and that we're going to adapt to them. We know that we're going to be able to cut administrative costs at public schools, or at public colleges and public vocational schools. We know that we're going to be able to reduce costs overall. So that's going to reduce that number overall. But we can't be so paralyzed by fear over the looming costs now that we do nothing about it, because as the longer we sit on this $1.5 trillion debt bubble and rising, the worse it's going to get. And that bubble is going to burst. And mm-hmm. it's not just going to affect people with student debt. This is another reason why it's important for us to come together as a society and fight back. It's not just going to affect me who has student debt and not you who doesn't have student debt. It's going to affect everybody. It is going to be an indiscriminate burst that is going to hurt everybody. It's going to hurt the housing market. It's going to hurt housing values. It's going to hurt rents. It's going to hurt everything. And we can't just try and isolate it as people with and people without, because it's more than that. It's going to affect both groups equally. So we have to come together as a society and fight back. We do the same anytime that we're faced with any sort of physical national threat, right? We came together after 9/11, regardless of who was affected and who wasn't. We coalesced. And this is the same kind of thing. It's going to affect us indiscriminately. We have to come together and coalesce to fight it.
Sarah Smith joining me in studio. She's running against Adam Smith in Washington's 9th Congressional District. Let's talk about a couple issues that are happening right now that people are talking about. You've taken a position that Donald Trump should be impeached, that you would at least support the impeachment. What crime did he commit?
I think we see collusion everywhere. He's
What's the crime that he committed?
He's profiting off his presidency. And
how?
We specifically make that illegal. It's the emoluments clause, right?
But what specifically, how is he benefiting? Because we've heard the accusation of that, but we haven't seen actual evidence.
Every time he goes to his golf courses, who owns his golf courses? He does. Who makes money off his golf courses?
So we can't go to
he does.
That's what you would impeach the president for?
He's spending taxpayer dollars to increase his own profits on his own businesses. Doesn't that seem like a conflict of interest?
To go to his own property?
To spend U.S. taxpayer dollars to make himself profits at his own businesses.
How much profit is he making? I guess I don't.
I think
that's
the last figure I saw was something like $10 million is what's been spent so far.
So you mean just because the notion that he's traveling there and we have to pay for him to travel there, you're saying that is...
He's traveling to his own resort where he's spending our money on his own resort, and his resort is taking that money and it's posting it as a profit. I mean, it's textbook emoluments clause, right?
So you think that's an impeachable offense?
Absolutely, I do. I think it's a full conflict of interest. Every other president before him has divested themselves from their businesses and focused solely on the office of the presidency. He refuses to divest himself.
What's the collusion?
That's what I meant by emoluments clause.
That's what you meant.
Yeah,
didn't mean collusion. You meant
I misspoke. I'm sorry.
do you think that there is? Do you think he's working with Vladimir Putin or anyone within the Russian government?
I think that the second you stand up in front of the world and you say your own country's intelligence agencies are wrong and Vladimir Putin is right, I think that we really need to take a hard look and ask ourselves, is there evidence that he's not working at that point? I mean,
that's not how the law works.
Yes, I understand. But he's denouncing his own country's intelligence agencies. I think there's a reason for that. And I think that Mueller doing his job is going to expose a lot more about that. We're seeing, I think, Paul Manafort goes up today.
Mm-hmm.
And he's on trial for these kinds of things. And I mean,
well, he's on trial for tax evasion, unrelated at all to the Trump stuff.
But I mean, I think Mueller is finding things. I'm trying to keep an open mind. I'm open to the idea of impeaching Trump. Once we get harder evidence and stronger evidence, I think that we still have this emoluments clause issue.
So, but you're not open to not supporting an impeachment, right? I mean, it sounds like you're saying
if there's no evidence for it,
Mueller comes back and there's no indictments, there's nothing.
Then if there's absolutely nothing and Mueller comes back and he's like, look, Trump has this clean slate, then I mean, you know, if we don't have the legal evidence to present, then we don't have the legal evidence to present.
So another big issue that actually I think you might agree with Donald Trump on, 3D printed guns. He sent out a tweet Tuesday morning suggesting that he wants to talk with the Department of Justice to say, why are we allowing this to go, that people have access to this information on how to print 3D weapons. What's your general take on that? Because it seems like this is more of a nuanced conversation than just saying, you know, Attorney General Bob Ferguson, they're suing to prevent this. What's your general take?
So I think the ability to 3D print guns is ridiculous. I don't think he's wrong about that, but I think maybe our motivations might be different.
What are the motivations?
I think that we have a real concern that the NRA is saying, oh, 3D printing guns is stopping our dealers from making money. Therefore, we need to stop them from 3D printing guns. I think it's just wrong to 3D print guns, and it's harder to keep track of these things. And it's harder to fight back against gun crime and gun violence when we allow people to download 3D printing models. We do need to crack down on this. Maybe he and I are coming from different perspectives. Mm-hmm. I don't live in his head.
What would you have the federal government do? Because obviously, you know, this is about putting information online, the blueprints.
Yes.
And so the only way to stop that is to censor the material, right?
And I am a fan of net neutrality, so I do not believe in internet censorship. But I think that anytime these kinds of plans are downloaded, I think that we need to keep an eye on who has them and where they're going.
You monitor that?
Yes, I mean, how do you monitor it?
What you would basically be saying is, if I download it, if Jason Rance downloads this, you want the government to track me?
I want them to know who has the plans.
How would they do that?
Yeah, tracking. Yeah, they'd have to track it. So,
is that legal?
I think it should be, if it's not already. I mean, I think that that's one way that we really need to start looking at things like that. I do believe in the right to bear arms. I believe any time that we're in a police state that you can't disarm the populace. I do not believe in a total gun ban. But I do believe that in the age of modern weaponry, we do need to be smart about these mm-hmm. kinds of things. I mean, look at the Second Amendment. Do you think they really planned the Second Amendment for 3D printed guns? Do you think they ever could have imagined it?
Do you think, though, that they planned the First Amendment for the internet? Do you think they planned anything in the Constitution for abortion? Right? I mean, these are things that at the time they weren't thinking of. It was more the principles of the thing. And yes, I do think from a principle standpoint, they supported the internet, even though they didn't know about it. I think they supported the ability to protect yourself against a government agency.
Sure. And I think that that was right, especially coming from the age that they did, right? They were fleeing this oppressive kingdom of the UK and coming over here.
And they had their versions of machine guns. It was just dramatically different than what we have. Yes.
Wildly different. But I mean, even in the Constitution, it gives us the ability to come together and say, if these laws no longer apply in modern times, we have an obligation to rewrite the Constitution. We need to look at technology around us and ask ourselves if now is the time to consider it. I mean, it's...
Well, then what would you ban? Or what would you support banning from that perspective?
I'd support banning a lot of things that most people think is common sense. We talk about common sense gun control. I actually don't like that term. I like the term progressive gun control or proactive gun control because it takes into account things like bump stocks. Mm-hmm. It takes into account things like high capacity magazines, like civilians purchasing armor piercing rounds. What are you hunting that you need armor piercing rounds for?
Well, what would you specifically ban as far as guns? Because we've heard the situation of like AR-15s, which...
AR-15s is...
But they're not being used in a meaningful way to commit these acts of violence that we are concerned with.
So it wouldn't matter if we banned them, right?
No, I think it does matter. Because then at what point, if you're willing to say, okay, AR-15s, which we acknowledge statistically, mm-hmm. you're unlikely to die from an AR-15. We would agree with that. Right? Statistically, that's not... But those are not the crimes that are happening. The crimes that are happening are with handguns. The majority of the crimes that are had, the deaths that are occurring with guns are happening from handguns. And so if the argument is not that many people are even involved with AR-15s, we might as well get rid of them. Well, couldn't you then make the argument, but handguns are, so we should absolutely get rid of them because we're already getting rid of the stuff that doesn't even matter.
So I do support the ownership of semi-automatic weapons, but not automatic weapons and not...
Which is already illegal.
Yes,
though.
Which is already illegal and not materials that allow you to modify a firearm to become an automatic weapon.
Do you support the banning of AR-15s without any modification?
I do support the banning of AR-15s.
Okay, explain that then.
So I think that it's one of those high-powered guns that just really... It doesn't have a place in hunting. It doesn't have a place in home defense. It is a military-grade weapon.
It's not military-grade. It's military-style in the sense that it looks scary, but it's obviously different than
an automatic weapon. I mean, but then all guns are scary. All guns are military, right? But I mean, I think that at this stage, I mean, AR-15s are what we read about all the time. They're semi-automatics, but they're one of those guns that's easily modified to become an automatic. And that's something that we need to be concerned about.
But that's
about.
Not happening all that often.
But it does happen.
Well, lots of things happen. But I mean, when the people do that, they're doing it in a legal way.
But just because it happens often doesn't mean we shouldn't do anything to curb it from happening at all.
But your goal is to curb gun violence.
Yes.
Okay. So if the majority of the gun violence is being used with a handgun, why then would you not support banning a handgun?
I do support regulations on handguns as well. I actually support things like mandatory training and licensing. I do support things like a cooling off period. I support things like a background check. I do support our constitutional right to bear arms, especially in light of the fact that we do live in a militarized state.
What does that mean?
It means that our police are armed, that our military is armed, our National Guard is armed. Therefore, the populace must be armed as well, right? Because the only way to fight, you know, in any kind of meaningful way is to have the same kind of weaponry that the people around you have.
But you don't believe that because you don't want us to have AR-15s.
I don't want to have them because you have to look at things in a root cause way as well. Mm. So I try to take a holistic approach to all this stuff. So when we talk about guns, we talk about the gun itself, which people say guns don't kill people. Guns do kill people. It really helps, right? You know, guns don't kill people. People kill people. But the gun really makes it a lot easier.
Well, the person pulling... Certainly, if a gun was here right now, you and I would not use it against each other to kill each other, right?
So,
and the gun would not.
I hope not.
I'm a friendly guy, just because I'm a conservative. But the gun itself is not going mm-hmm. to shoot either of us. It would. One of us has to reach for the weapon and use it. So, I mean, this whole idea that we're the reason why I think people say it's not the gun that kills people, it's the people that kill people, is because we tend to ignore the actual person and the motivation behind
the killing.
But that's one of the things that I'm trying to say is the way that I approach proactive gun legislation, it accounts for those kinds of things, like not allowing persons with a violent mental health history to obtain firearms, not allowing persons with a history of domestic violence, the expanding mental health care, and not just talking about expanding it, but actually putting our money where our mouth is and doing it, destigmatizing things like mental health care, giving people the ability to come forwards and talk about these things. This is all part of progressive gun legislation. These things are intertwined. They're inextricably linked, but we also have to make sure that we're accounting for the weapon itself as well. We can't just treat one without the other. There's no magic cure. We have to look at both, and we have to look at both proactively. And I'm not saying I want to disarm the populace. I don't believe in a total gun ban, but I do believe in responsible, proactive gun control. And it's nothing crazy. It's nothing that most people won't look and say, oh, well, yeah, I'm a law-abiding citizen. I don't mind having a license or having training. I think it's most people I've talked to who are responsible gun owners.
To have a license?
I think it would be great for people to have a license.
Who pays for that?
I mean, I'd like, we have the DMV. We can do something similar like that with guns. I mean,
yeah, but one obviously is that you have a constitutional right to own a weapon. And so my issue with all of this is because I like background checks. Awesome. I don't think we should have to pay for them the same way that,
sure,
you know, when we talk about having an ID to vote, usually the left will say, well, that you're charging someone to vote and you can't do that because it's a constitutionally protected right. Well, so is bearing arms.
Sure. So is bearing arms. I mean, I do agree with you that it is a constitutional right. I think that the onus should be on the seller of the firearms to cover the cost for these kinds of things. I mean, if it's part of the cost of doing business, right? Cost of doing business is you have to pay for someone to be licensed. You have to pay for someone to do a background check. We see it whenever we apply for jobs, too, right? They run a background check on us and the company always pays for it. I mean, as long as we're not charging things like exorbitant fees, obviously. I'm not in favor of ridiculously extortionist fees to prevent anybody. I think
that's good to know.
Yeah, of course. I'm definitely not a fan of exorbitant fees for these kinds of things. But I think that, you know, a nominal fee to be covered by the business that's selling the firearm should be covered by them and not by the person who's purchasing it.
Last question for you, probably the toughest one. Why should a conservative, why should a Republican vote for you?
Why should a Republican vote for me? Because, man, I think that these terms like Republican and conservative and Democrat and things like that, I think they're ridiculous. If we align on enough things, if we share enough ideology, if we all are working class people struggling to survive, we're all working class people trying to make this country a better place. We're all working class people who see someone broken down on the side of the road and get out and help them push their car, right?
I'm not doing that.
What are you, I just did that the other day.
They could have an AR-15 and I'm scared.
But I mean, you know, at the end of the day, our struggles are exactly the same. Our struggles don't care if we're Democrat or Republican. Our wages don't care if we're red or blue. We're suffering. We're hurting. And I want to make everybody's lives better. I don't just want to go fight for Democrats. I don't just want to go fight for progressives. I want to fight for everybody. I've reached out to libertarians. I've reached out to progressives. I've had to conservatives. I've reached out to Republicans because these conversations are important. Different perspectives are important. But at the end of the day, I want to represent all of us in the 9th District. I don't just want to represent one group of voters over another. I want to make sure that we're all fighting for the same kind of dream, right? I want to protect everybody's basic civil rights. I want to protect everybody's dignity to life. I want to improve the lives of all people. And I consider the perspective of Republicans and conservatives to be important. That's why I'm here, because I think it's an important perspective to take. And it challenges me. And I think that's important. And if Republicans find any kind of resonance with my message, if they're sick and tired of the same things I am, if they're sick and tired of politics as usual, of bought and paid for politicians, of people that aren't going to go work for them or listen to them, if they're sick of that, then vote for me, because I care about your perspective. I care about the things you have to bring to the table. I care about what you think about legislation and policy. And though we disagree and that we don't always get on the same page, it's important to have those conversations. And I want to represent those conversations. Even if I can't agree with you on the policy, I want at least to be able to have those discussions with you.
That's Sarah Smith. She's running for Congress in the 9th District against Adam Smith. I appreciate you stopping by in studio. That's always a plus.
Yes.
And hey, look at you talking to conservatives. I like that.
You guys don't scare me. I like you.
We're very friendly people. I find myself incredibly charming. Sarah Smith, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you.